Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. Today is our first panel of our day of special analysis of Housing for All, the new landmark housing plan that was going to solve the housing crisis. So let's see, will it? We have experts, analysts, politicians, activists today, all day from different perspectives, people who are involved and affected by the crisis. And just before we get started, a reminder to listeners, please support Reboot Republic in what we're doing. These podcasts cost, we really know you value them. We are the independent media. If you don't want an ad for McDonald's, please become a patron supporter. Sign up to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you very much. So I'm joined in our first Housing for All panel, Housing for All Developers and Investors, by Keane O'Callaghan, TD, Leisha Neelan with the Dublin Inquirer, Mick Byrne from UCD, Killian Woods from the Sunday Business Post, and Orla Hegarty from UCD as well. Just in terms of maybe to start with, Keane, just in terms of your quick reaction to the plan, kind of key points of analysis to start with. Cheers.
Yeah, and there's a good bit in it, but you know, I suppose firstly, the thing that's really striking me that's missing from it is, and Fianna Fáil had promised in the election campaign, 10,000 affordable purchase direct built homes each year. They're very clear about that in black and white in the manifesto. And that's basically not in it. They are, you know, reading between the lines, they are talking about maybe 1,000 affordable purchase homes next year, and that going up to maybe about 2,000, hopefully the year after. So over the lifetime of the government, they're not going to reach what they said they'd deliver, you know, each year. So that's going to be hugely disappointing for people who are, you know, looking for that and needing those kind of affordable purchase, you know, the Coulon type affordable purchase homes at about 250,000 euro or thereabouts. The delivery on cost rental, you know, is quite low also. You think if there's more than 300,000 households renting privately, paying very high rents, amongst the highest in Europe. So the fact that we're looking at 1,000 next year, maybe going to 2,000 after that, cost rental homes, of course, better than having none, but it's not meeting the kind of demand that we need. It's really a drop in the ocean. And then in terms of social housing numbers, and they're talking about, you know, 9,000 next year, when like this year's the budget for this year was projecting up to 13,000 social homes. So, you know, potentially looking at an actual decrease in what was being promised, certainly for 2021, not what's been delivered, but what was being promised for 2021. And then even, you know, things around, you know, it says phase out long-term leasing, but there's no date in it, there's no stop it. And in fact, the government, as we know at the moment, is ramping up long-term leasing of social housing. So good that they're saying that they're going to end it, but that kind of language around phasing out, you know, is certainly, I think, quite worrying. And then you look, there's things missing as well, like in terms of renters, there's very little there to improve security of tenure or bring us in line with other European countries. Even things around on climate change and the retrofitting of our current social housing stock, you know, the ambition on that is quite low for 2030. It's not going at the scale that's needed. And look, there's a good bit more in it as well, but just to start in those points.
Yeah. Thanks, Keane. Orla, what's your analysis of it?
Thanks, Rory. I suppose I don't want to blind people with numbers. I think it would be easy to do that. To maybe reverse out a little bit from the context, I always think it's good to look at some of the assumptions underneath, you know, underpinning this. And there's two things I'd pick out to start with. One, I think, is that Minister Pascal Donoghue yesterday was talking about how it would be financed. And clearly they're assuming that the pandemic is pretty much over and won't need any more funding, and that they will be in a position to borrow from 2023. So there's a few, I would say, uncertainties and unknowns in that assumption. And the second one is economist John Fitzgerald has been out discussing migration patterns and how uncertain everything is at the moment with, will people emigrate? Will people come to work here? Will people come back? Will they want to live in the city? And one of the huge underlying assumptions in this is a very high migration and population growth. You know, so they're taking the top end of the ESRI figures rather than a midpoint or a low point. And I, you know, we don't know that that demand is there. It feels like they're giving confidence to the market rather than looking hard at, you know, what's needed. Because there's a very strong assumption in there that everything is new built. You know, and that the demand is really high. The need is really high. The need for housing is really high, but the market demand is actually quite low. And, you know, I think it's ambitious to assume that more than half of our people will be able to afford their own housing, given that there isn't an objective in here to make housing more affordable.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty profound fundamental point. And I think it's really well made, Orla, around that. What the difference between demand and need, and maybe just explain that a little bit more, because I think it is fundamental here.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, just by my rough estimate, you know, just looking at the numbers yesterday, it's assumed that the private market will deliver about half to people who can fully afford their own housing. Okay. And it's assumed that there's a kind of subsidy to ownership for another group. So nearly 2/3 of this is people who will either buy their own housing, rent their own housing, or get a bit of a subsidy to buy their own housing. Okay, so that's 2/3 of it. So they're kind of, that's quite a big assumption, given that 90% of people can't afford to live in Dublin. You know, how's that gap being filled? You know, you can't assume that 2/3 of the people in Dublin will be either able to buy a home or buy one with a 50,000 subsidy. That just doesn't stack up with salary levels. And nothing that was said yesterday was about making housing actually affordable. There was a lot said about reassuring the market and filling the gap for affordability. But filling a gap is public subsidy. And, you know, will other taxpayers be happy with that we're giving 50 or 100,000 of public money to fill a gap, which nearly is another land bailout, you know, because it's not paying for the bricks and mortar, it's paying for the land.
Yeah, I think that's a fundamental point as well. Orla, I'm going to come back to you and maybe that key question of how can we actually make housing affordable? Mick Byrne, what's your take on it?
My biggest response, I think, is that home ownership is back. We saw under Rebuilding Ireland, there was a big shift in government discourse towards what we call tenure neutrality, so not prioritizing home ownership.
Yeah.
And even almost what you could call a prioritization of the rental sector. So there's a lot of talk in the Rebuilding Ireland document about how we need a mature rental sector, a European-style rental sector to make renting a tenure of choice, et cetera, et cetera. And that was backed up with the National Rental Strategy and the big emphasis on build to rent, which obviously many people disagree with. But that was the vision there. Here, what we're seeing, Dara O'Brien is saying he believes in home ownership. Leo Varadkar talking yesterday about home ownership being central to our culture. The document itself says home ownership is good for you, literally.
Yeah.
So it's quite striking that the extent to which they're billing this as a pro-home ownership plan, and they're aiming to tackle the decline in home ownership explicitly. What's that going to mean for renters? I think there's an inequality story here, because what we might see is that some renters who are in relatively decent economic situation, for example, a two-income couple, may be getting the support they need to get into home ownership. And no doubt they'll be very happy about some of the policies that are in the Housing for All document. But then a lot of people being left behind. For example, low-income households, as Orla is saying, who aren't going to be able to access home ownership even with these supports. 40% of renters are migrants, non-Irish-born households. Are we going to see a concentration of migrants who are often on low incomes left behind in a rental sector, which the government is more or less, I don't want to say abandoning, but certainly not focusing on? And then people on HAP who aren't eligible for cost rental housing. That's fundamental. So the assumption is, I think there's a danger here that we're going to see a kind of a residualization of the private rental sector and an excessive focus on homeownership. I understand that. I mean, I understand why people want to be homeowners. And I definitely understand the political calculation here of thinking there's votes in homeownership, there's not votes in reforming the rental sector. But in terms of the impact on the housing system, I think that's a big danger.
But I think it's a very interesting point, Mick. And I make the point in my article in the Examiner today when I was looking at it last night, the plan, that even the percentage, if you look at the numbers, they're talking about 36,000 affordable homes being made available over 10 years. Like that would, on current static, you know, add maybe 3% to the home ownership rate. Like it's a, you know, tiny proportion of those who are renting. So it's not really expanding home ownership. It's even that in and of itself. I don't think so anyway. There's a rhetoric, there's a language, there's a clear aspiration, but there's even no delivery plan for actual affordable home ownership. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I mean, that brings us back to the funding issue. The framing is very much in terms of we're backing home ownership, but the funding for the plan as a whole is disappointing, and it's not the radical game changer that I think we were promised essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make all aspects of the plan, including the hoped for revival of home ownership, very hard to deliver.
Yeah. And I think as well, there's a contradiction in the continued support and backing of investment funds, because they are one of the key blockages to people being able to afford their own home. So I think there's a real contradiction there, and that's not been worked out and thought through, or definitely not considered. And I think they're leading themselves, I think, very open politically to failing utterly to expand home ownership, even, which is what they want to, because at the other hand, they're allowing investment funds to continue, which will lock out continually generation rent. Thanks, Mick. Leisha Neelan from Dublin Inquirer, what was your take on it?
Hi, Rory. Yeah, I tried to kind of take a look at this from the practical perspective of covering Dublin City Council to see will anything change within the council in the coming kind of year or two. I think there's nothing in there about reforming the four-stage approval process. So the issue is that the council just can't draw down the money to build all these homes. So I don't know how they're going to deliver 10,000 social homes when the councils take years to get their hands on the money.
Yeah.
You know, there was high level commitments under the last programme as well for all the social homes that were going to be built. It didn't happen. I can't see anything in this immediately that's going to change those issues.
Mm.
Unless they're going to give the council's money up front, they won't be able to deliver 10,000 social homes. That was one thing. The other thing I thought, like, there are some really good things in here. I thought, I wanted to say something positive. I thought that the idea of the land value sharing, I don't understand exactly how it's going to work. But obviously, if there is land going to be rezoned and if the state is going to get involved in taking some of that profit, that's brilliant. If that money is reinvested back into housing, I mean, I think that's an absolutely excellent idea. Really disappointed.
Just a point on that, though. It is an excellent idea, absolutely positive, but it's not coming in until 2026 or 2027.
Like, okay.
This is the problem.
Yeah, that's, you know, too late. Similar with the vacant homes tax. They're talking about the idea of it. They think they need to do more investigation into how many homes are vacant. We don't need any investigation. We don't need to know precisely how many homes are vacant to bring in a vacant homes tax. That could come in and then you figure out who has to pay it. Like, that's the way these things normally work. They didn't identify every Airbnb before they brought in the Airbnb regulations. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what we do know is that there are thousands of vacant homes that are ready to be habitable in the city right now. And that's being permitted to continue under this plan. That would be the easiest way, I think, and the most environmentally friendly way and the most cost-effective way to free up homes in the city centre immediately would be to bring in a vacant homes tax. So that was very urgent, and unfortunately that's not there. The other thing that's not there is any reform of homeless services. There's a ideological aspiration to end homelessness, which is very laudable, but that's been in the last plans as well. I think the last end date for homelessness was 2010, and then before or after that, then it was 2016. So I don't think there is anything in there that would indicate to me that they're going to achieve the ending of homelessness. So in light of that, it would be good to see some reform of homeless services And that again would be urgent. So yeah, there's a lot of things that aren't in there. Another thing is there seems to be a commitment to deliver social housing through public-private partnerships.
Yeah.
That's very problematic as well. And I don't know how that will, I don't understand the reasoning for that or why they don't want to just build directly themselves. To do those numbers and to get involved in those kind of deals, it just seems very complicated. So yeah, and then there's nothing really immediate for currently for renters either. So there's nothing in there for somebody who's currently paying $2,000 a month in rent and can't afford to save anything towards a deposit, do you know?
Well, there's the, as Mick says, there's the belief in home ownership, you know. If they believe in home ownership strong enough, you know, it's like the AIB ad, back in Brave, they're back in Brave, you know. But when you go in to look for the mortgage, they say, you don't quite fit, you know that?
Yeah, there's a lot of things like that. And there's a lot of them. It's a lot of it is very aspirational. There's a lack of smart goals, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think your point, really.
Yeah. I think your point really needs further discussion. Obviously, unfortunately, we don't have time today to go into detail, but I think your question of how will councils actually and AHBs deliver this in practice? Because when we look at the numbers of units up to this point, like last year, that are declared as new build social housing are actually bought from the private sector, these so-called turnkey units. So I think there's a major question, and even the capacity, where is the, you know, the capacity going to come from? But listen, Leisha, thanks for that. And the homelessness issue is another really important one. And I made the point also in the article today in the Examiner, looking at it, that there's two contradictory targets in their homelessness targets. On the one hand, they say they're going to increase capital investment in expanding emergency accommodation, but they're also going to support the investment in converting emergency accommodation into owned or social housing. So I haven't quite worked out how they're both going to work at the same time.
Yeah, and the Housing First targets aren't that ambitious either. I mean, they're talking about an extra 240 Housing First placements each year, which is great, but there's more than 240 single homeless people becoming homeless every year. So a lot more, you know what I mean? So like,
yeah,
at the best, we'll start to stand still if they increase. There's nothing in there that looks like
they do nothing on evictions.
Yeah, exactly. Without a ban on evictions, without any of those other measures that would actually reduce homelessness, I don't think 240 Housing First placements on its own is going to do it.
Yeah, no, I think there is a development, and it's important to acknowledge that from Rebuilding Ireland did not aim to end homelessness. Rebuilding Ireland never set that out. It just aimed to address it and reduce it. Whereas at least this one, well, now, if you look at the language, they say we will work to end homelessness, not we will end homelessness and all this.
Yeah, there's nothing in there to show us how they're going to end homelessness. Yeah, that's the thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Listen, Leisha, thanks. I'll come back to you. Cillian Woods, Sunday Business Post, senior reporter, breaker of the biggest investment fund story of all
time.
That's
enough. That's enough now. Come on, right? Yeah.
Go on, your take.
You're running out of any titles there. Just a few points. I suppose starting a positive. I read through the report last night, and it's interesting to see some of the terminologies now used in, and that's like terminology that some politicians, mainly in government, have avoided using: crisis, rent trap, dysfunctional. That is mentioned a good few times through the piece. Now the 160 page document repeats itself a lot. It's maybe not exactly 160 pages. There's the same stuff kind of cropping up in many different parts of it. It was quite quick to read near the end because it was the same stuff coming up and up again. That's one positive, though. At least they're mentioning crisis. Like, the Rebuilding Ireland had crisis in the first line of it when it was launched in 2016, and never mentioned it once again. At least it was mentioned a couple of times, and mentioned yesterday even that there is a crisis. That helps. It's been a long time trying to get them to recognise that there's a crisis. Just other things that come up, like kind of burning questions with climate change. Is this tested? I put it to senior civil servants yesterday, whether this is tested sustainable and in a sustainable manner. And the kind of a wishy-washy answer of like, we're going to try and do it, but like, there's a lot. I'm not saying we don't build homes because climate change is coming, but it doesn't seem to necessarily be at the core of it either. It doesn't seem much thought has gone to, we're throwing all these homes out there, but you know, how will that affect our carbon emission goals? And there's not one mention of modular homes in there. Not that I'm a big, you know, lobbyist for modular homes, but just little things that would actually help the industry innovate. Like, there's talks of a construction center of excellence or for to help them innovate. construction sector hasn't really innovated a lot from what I can see in a very long time. Same homes, same style been built. Then again, a lot of it's, and then in jumping between ideas, so much of it just exposes how little data is collected on you know, the housing sector. Like, they're going to increase, they're going to expand data sharing arrangements between the RTB and revenue in Q1 of 2023. First of all, why is that not happening now? And why is it going to take to 2023? Like, those are two things that should be linking up. And then you go down to the, like, we can't do a vacant property levy apparently because, sorry, that we can't do this vacant property levy because we don't have the data for it. Why has that not been collected already? Like, this is again exposing that we don't collect proper information on housing. You can't make informed policy without the data, or you can't rely on industry data, which is obviously skewed in their favor. One other thing that didn't come up in the yesterday, which I found in the fine print, is that they are talking about labor demand going up to 67,500 from kind of the 40,000 it is in the construction sector at the moment. But they say as the backlog of housing output has built up, a further increase, possibly up to 80,000 workers, may be necessary. So we're looking at not just like adding, we're looking at doubling labor in the sector, a sector that I think even Cian O'Callaghan had earlier in the year, like, shown that there's just not some people going into certain trades and going into the sector. So that was quite well hidden. Then the word average, to talk about going into terminology, the word average comes up a lot. That's a very clever way of saying we're not hitting our targets for the next few years and that we will overcompensate near the end of the plan. Now, that gets into the kind of, how long is all this going to take effect for? You just said there's land sharing value. Again, land share value, that's going to take the way it works at the moment is that if they see that as their user or lose it, because they're going to go after you for that levy after 6 years, in 6 years' time, if the land has been zoned to kind of say you didn't do anything with the land, we're penalizing you now, here's your user or lose it. But like, that's going to take, as I said, 6 years is a long time to take effect. And even then, I don't know if that's fully tested. Like, it seems like something you could maybe rail against a bit as a developer. Like, we've seen developers fight development contributions before, and this is a very new one. Therefore, I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm just saying it is untested and not definite. Then the one thing you'll love is that maybe you saw yourself, but the Department of Finance is going to go to more trade shows to attract more institutional funds. I saw that. Because very, very few mentions of institutional funds, institutional investors in it. But that was one that, you know, the Department of Finance are going to take the lead on getting more institutional funds in, and they're going to go to these trade shows. So maybe I need to be going to these trade shows. Sounds a bit of fun.
Yeah, I did read that and I was struck by that. The only mention, as you said, of institutional investment funds was this reference to the Department of Finance actively going out as if NAMA hadn't done it already and as if we didn't have enough. Do you think that's significant, Cillian? And how do you see that play out in terms of the role of institutional investment funds here in Ireland? Because my reading of this plan is we're going to likely see them just continue, particularly in the area of buying up apartments and building apartments, building built to rent.
Well, yeah, because the rules that are mainly brought in to counter them have been watered. Well, again, this isn't housing for all. This is pre-housing for all. They've been watered down. You know, essentially, if you're going to lease to the state, you've got the stamp duty exemption. There's no definite end to that. Well, I think they said 2025 is where they're phasing out leasing, but that's a long time. So it's 2021. Like, that's 4 years away of phasing out leasing. I said the fewer mentions of it, you could say, well, there's nothing in housing for all for institutional investors if there's few mentions of them. But fewer mentions means there's less to actually impact how they're operating right now. So it's kind of a win-win. It's a win for them. It's a pretty good environment for them to be operating in right now. Few mentions of how they're going to clamp down their activity or whether they want that activity. Like I said, Mick said earlier. You know, this home ownership is at the center. This seems to be at the center of this plan, or it says it is a lot. But I don't know how you pivot towards that without clamping down on something that's absolutely, I don't mean rife in a bad way, but it is just rife in the market because they've been allowed to run rampant through the market. And some people feel that they should be allowed to run rampant through the market because they'll help solve the problem. Others don't. I just don't see how you don't push that home ownership without clamping down on funds because it's so skewed in their favor. The environment, the playing field. I don't see how you don't have to. You have to clamp down on that to help homeowners.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely true. Cillian, thanks. Just to go back, I'm going to go back to each of my panelists and give you a minute each to say what you think should have been in the plan, one or two things that should have been in the plan that weren't in there. So we'll go rapid fire through and then we'll finish up. So Keane O'Callaghan, do you want to go first, TD with the Social Democrats?
Look, what should have been in it is 10,000 affordable purchase homes, as Fianna Fáil promised in the last election. Should be a whole load of stuff in there on climate change, much more ambitious around retrofitting. There should be things like the vacant sites tax should be actioned now. They just need to make decisions on that. They need to decide what the exemptions are going to be. For example, you know, if someone is if their home is empty because they're in they're unwell and they're in hospital or whatever, they need to decide on those exemptions, bring it in. On homelessness, for example, there needs to be detail there. The housing first tenancies over 5 years, I mean, they should be done much more quickly. They could be done in over 1 or 2 years to get those extra 1,200 housing first tenancies in. So that's a start. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers, Keane. Orla Hegarty.
I think there's three things I think should be. Sorry. Firstly, I think there should be an ambition to what success would look like. You know, just numbers and piling up poor standard housing and in wrong and unsustainable locations and putting people into debt isn't a solution for the country. I'd like to see some vision. But I think the three words I would like to see as priorities are capacity. We need a plan for increasing capacity in the sector. And that hasn't been there, and vested interests don't want it to be there because that's more competition. I'd like to see affordability as a core strategy so that we use, we plan that the majority of people can fund their own housing. It's not good to see this same repeated trope that construction in Ireland is astronomical and nobody can afford their own home. That's wrong. And that's part of this kind of false narrative. So I'd like to see, as I said, capacity, affordability, and the third one being quality. There's very little here about what type of housing and how enduring it will be in terms of sustainability and suitable to needs. Half of the households in Ireland have children. And again, this report only talks about children in the context of homelessness and I think direct provision, a little bit like the last plan. You know, what kind of communities are we building for families and for our children, and how will they, you know, how will they get to school? Where will they play? How will their families be able to afford the football boots and the dancing lessons if they're up to their eyes in debt? You know, so I think it's missing some of the human side.
Yeah, thanks, Orla. Mick Byrne?
I'd probably say three things. The number one issue, I think, is probably for me the funding. I don't think there's enough detail really in the document to get a full picture of the capital spending specifically on delivering new housing of various types. But we spoke, were we on this podcast before, about the ESRI paper from a few months back, which called for, I think, capital funding for social housing to be doubled, and really for the state to commit very seriously to borrowing whatever it takes to solve the housing crisis, given the current fiscal and monetary context. So that's not there. Maybe it'd be going too far to say it's conservative in funding terms, but it's not got the ambition to deliver on a radical change, in my view. So that's the big one. And of course, that would have been the most politically contentious generally, and between, I imagine, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as well. A freebie here was security of tenure for tenants. Why has it not been delivered? Nobody. It's just literally unfathomable how we can still not have this. It does make a very vague reference to indefinite tenancies. That was already in Rebuilding Ireland and never manifested. So I don't believe that we will see real security of tenure, and I don't see any intention here to change that. And then finally, what they're talking about is 2,000, I think it's 2,000 cost rental per year, roughly, and 4,000 affordable purchase, roughly. I would have loved to see no affordable purchase and 6,000 cost rental, which could have been delivered kind of within the context of the plan, let's say. And more than that, of course, it would have been really brilliant to see 10,000 cost rental and 10,000 social housing units, or 14,000 social housing units and 6,000 cost rental units, but numbers more in that territory. I think the affordable purchase is maybe at this scale, it's not going to have a huge impact. And some of the affordable purchase measures are going to be inflationary, like the shared equity. And I would have much rather seen it just a really strong commitment to social and cost rental.
Yeah. Great, Mick. Thank you so much. Leisha?
Yeah, I think to deliver the 10,000 social homes, you'd have to reform the current approval process the councils go through to get the money. So if you want to see any big public housing building, that's not going to happen as long as we still have the system we have. So there doesn't seem to be anything in there about changing that. Definitely the vacant homes thing. It's such a ludicrous scenario at the moment to see all of these empty, perfectly good new build homes while there's such a severe housing crisis. It could have been done long ago. And I guess then also, yeah, just like I said, the reform of homeless services, there's nothing in there at all about bringing in inspections or anything like that to actually make sure that this accommodation is safe for people. Unfortunately, we are going to have homelessness for the next decade going forward. And yeah, there doesn't seem to be much in there really about ending that either.
Great. Thanks, Leisha. And then Killian.
This is the problem about signing on to the call late, that I have to go last and there's no ideas left.
you have no lack of ideas, Killian.
I'm going to steal yours, Rory. I think, as we were talking about there, I think there's genuinely, actually, joking aside, there's quite a lack of just even acknowledgement in the Housing for All plan about institutional investors. Like, they're not all, but it's not that they're the evil character in this housing story, but they just, it, like, you need to address that, what their role they're having on the market, and just talk, but even just write about that. This, there was sections of it that weren't dedicated to policy. They're just dedicated to setting the scene for why stuff is coming up or what has been put in place. And to just, like, it wasn't even put down. Like, a lot of the stuff in the plan, all these, like, I think it was 260, I think the minister said yesterday, different points that are actionable in it. Not one of them even says, like, that there's a new stamp duty rate to clamp down on bulk purchasing. Like, this is the housing plan. It doesn't even mention it in it. And that's one of the most important, probably one of the most important pieces of housing, like, you know, new housing rules and measures that came forward in the last few years. So just a section on them would have been worth it. Like, again, they are a huge part of the market. Some say they're only 15,000 homes in Ireland or whatever, but they have a huge foothold in the market in Ireland. It's a sector that, and even to say something that would, stuff, maybe they'd be annoyed that there's not even anything in there to help them, anything in there that would actually be benefit them. You know, they would like probably some measures that actually play in their favor or to at least be put on paper. So I think it's just a lack of acknowledgement for institutional funds in the paper, because, and that again gets down to, we've fought a long road to get words like crisis and rent trap and dysfunctional to be used by, like, kind of government ministers, to just get them to address that there is an institutional investor market there that is having an effect. And it's really why this Housing for All plan, a lot of different measures are spin-offs of that, of the effect they have. Just put it in writing would have been helpful.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I would argue that that there is a very clear policy in there for investors, which is not touching rents. Because as long as rents remain absolutely inflated as they are, that's the incentive for investment funds.
And the record did say, and again, I thought it was, again, there's so many contradictions at the start when they're doing their, I took some of them down, but when they were doing their little spiel before and they did their speech, like, but the one thing Leo Riker said was there's a rent freeze. There's absolutely 100% not a rent freeze. It's tied to a low, like, inflation now, but there is not a rent freeze in any form at all in Ireland at the moment. He called it a rent freeze, not even an effective rent freeze, said there is a rent freeze. That is just not true. There's no rent freeze in Ireland.
Particularly when new units can be rented at whatever rate they want to be.
But part of the plan contradicted that, because it said that new units should come in at market rent. And that contradicts what they are coming in at. They're coming in at whatever rate they feel the market should be. So actually, that's something that I'm looking to query now the Department of Housing, because it does explicitly say in it that these new builds should be coming in at market rent, but they absolutely aren't coming in, and there's no plans to make sure they come in at market rent. So I don't know what, and there's no actionable, there's no one of the 260 points to action that. So I found that interesting that they put it, that's a contradiction of what the scenario is at the moment.
It's a very interesting rabbit hole we could go down, Killian. What is the market rent? Because my understanding, it was three properties in an area, and you could bring these to a landlord and say, or landlords would say, if they could identify three areas at a certain rent, that this was the market rent, but that was my understanding. So if you're building three new units that now set the new market rent, maybe Maker, someone could clarify just on that one.
I think the market rent is defined in the Residential Tenancies Act as the rent that a willing tenant would pay to a willing landlord. In other words, you know, it's whatever the rent is, is the market rent. And I know tenant organizations always had a problem when they tried to challenge rents that were above the market rent, because, you know, it was tautological. Essentially, if you were paying that price for it, then that was the market rent. So it's just whatever's out there.
But this is problematic for cost rental as well, and all the affordability, because it's all linked to the market rent. And the market, so if it's 25% lower than the new build-to-rent apartment at...
Well, cost rental
for a one bed.
The rents and cost rental should be determined by the cost of provision. I think
they should be, but...
They say there's a target there for it to be 25% below market rent, but my understanding is that there's a target to keep cost at that level, not that the rents themselves would be pegged explicitly to market rent, because obviously that would, if that was the case, it would be catastrophic for cost rental. It would undermine the whole logic of the model.
Yeah, yeah. But what we're likely to see here, though, with the Part 5, the extra 10% on affordable, is a lot of those are going to be cost rental, and the developer is going to peg those at 25% below the highest rents that they charge in those developments. So that's where that's going to come in. So, you know, cost rental that's done by approved housing bodies, you know, should be more than 25% lower than the, you know, full market rent. But at that level, that's where a lot of these provisions that they have in the Affordable Housing Act, they have a lot of kind of get
potentially
out.
Keen, you could have a Part 5 development where 10%, yeah, where it's supposedly 20%, but it will be 10% for a while. Those units could be done as cost rental units by the developer investor fund itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And not actually even transferred to a local authority or a housing association.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now they could transfer them to manage them them or whatever, and some of them are talking about that because they don't want to do the management of them. But they would hold the ownership, and then after what would hopefully be 40 years, but after that, and this is all allowed for and under the Affordable Housing Bill and the things we're trying to raise in it, it would then revert to full ownership of the developer or the investor.
Yeah, wow. There's that's all allowed for,
and that's presumably the way it's intended to play out. But they're, you know, they're not going to write that down in the Housing for All document.
Yeah. No, I think there's some very significant points there around, particularly around cost rental and market rent. Killian, you'll have to let us know when you figure out what the market rent is, right?
I will, yeah. Don't worry.
Great. Listen, thank you so much, everyone. To Cian O'Callaghan, TD with the Social Democrats, Orla Hegarty from the UCD School of Architecture and School of Architecture, Orla, correct?
Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy.
I knew it was. Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy. Thank you so much. Mick Byrne from the UCD School of Social Work and Social Policy, and Leisha Nealon from the Dublin Inquirer, and Killian Woods, Senior Reporter with the Sunday Business Post. Thanks, everyone, for joining me today on the Housing for All analysis. And we will have more analysis later on today coming out with more panels. And also, reminder, please become a supporter of Reboot Republic. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. If you want to hear more of these, keep the lights on, keep the podcast, the cost to produce, not to pay me anything, but actually the actual physical whole hosting platform and all the production and great work that Tony Groves does and the Tortoise Shack platform. So please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Keep this show on the road. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.